So this is the section on the exegetical value of learning and using the Masoretic accents. All right, let's meet the rest of me for a moment. Hine ha mishpacha sheli, ishti Rachel, vehabanim sheli, Benaya, Nathanael, Greta, vekalev, nachnu garim ba Dallas, Texas. So all of you can understand that level of Hebrew. This is my family, my wife, and my kids, and we live in Dallas right now. If we had more time, I would ask you, mi atem u'me'ayin tavo'u, right, from Jonah, right? Because you've all studied the book of Jonah, right? Mi ata u'me'ayin tavo'u, right? That's what they ask Jonah, but we don't have time for that. If you want to do more of that, you can come to our session tomorrow about using modern language learning techniques to help with your biblical Hebrew, okay? So that's just a little preview for tomorrow. We're here actually to talk about the accents. So has anyone in here done one of these new popular things called an escape room? Some of you? I experienced it for the first time over the Christmas break here. The basic idea is you get locked in a room, there's a sort of a story that's going on, and you and your team have to work together to solve a number of puzzles that get you through a bunch of locked doors and locked safes, etc., and you have to escape before the time runs out. Otherwise, you fail, and sometimes there's catastrophic consequences, the world ends, etc., etc. Well, we got to experience this for the first time, and I didn't know this going in, but there is an all-seeing eye in every room. And this all-seeing eye is available. If you just call out for help at any moment, up on a little computer screen will pop little hints to help you along in the process. So this was great for our group. We didn't call for too many helps, but there were times where it definitely helped us. One time, she simply said over the computer screen, "You are overthinking it." And so we had to just go back to some simple basics and we solved the puzzle very quickly. But what if there was an all-seeing eye with you sitting in your Hebrew chair or sitting next to you in your study? Maybe it would be Ezra himself, the great scribe. What if he was sitting right there and able to help you? And you get stuck on some sentence, so you go to your shelf and you reach off and grab a grammar, or you go and you get a commentary to try to help solve this problem, but Ezra is sitting right there. You just needed to ask him for help. Well, I want to propose that this is similar to what we have with the accents. They've been written right into the text that you are reading, and yet most of us don't know what to do with them or how they help you understand what's going on with the Hebrew. And I would propose that while commentaries and grammars and all your exegetical tools are so valuable, don't throw them out, why don't you ask Ezra first? Or in this case, Aharon ben Asher, right? The great Masoretic that helped us get the Aleppo Codex. And so the Masoretic work to get the accents written down in your text is meant to help you. I'm encouraging you through this session, let's figure out how they can help you, so maybe you're motivated to learn what they can say and how you could turn to that first before you have to go to any other books outside of the printed text that you have. Well, what's in a name? These things, these accents, as I'm calling them here, have a lot of different names. One of the names is cantillation marks, or chanting the text. Many of you have been here to a Jewish synagogue service. You'll notice that the reading of the text is rather different. It's not read in a plain voice. If I was going to read this text in a plain voice, Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz. Okay, we're pretty comfortable with that. If you read it with the chanting, which is much more of an Eastern style, and many people would say if you read important texts at all, it ought to be sung, not just read in the plain voice. You would read it something like this. Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz ve'ha'aretz hayta tohu vavohu ve'choshech al pnei tohom ve'ruach Elohim merachefet al pnei hamayim. Okay, so you could maybe pick up in there, if you look at the word bereshit, it has that little curly mark under it, tipecha, and then right on the next line, hashamayim, also has the tipecha. So when I was chanting it there, bereshit, you can hear the melody. When I got to shemayim, it was hashamayim. So each of these little symbols indicates a basic melody that goes along with them. And there's a sequence of them. Sometimes they change a little bit. But that's one way they can be helpful. That's one function that they serve, and they're on every word throughout the text. Another function, which may be more useful for you, if you're not going to learn to actually chant them, is that they are accents. The vast majority of the time, if you're not comfortable reading the Hebrew out loud, the vast majority of the time, they're going to tell you which syllable to accent. Okay, just listen carefully. Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz. Ve'ha'aretz hayta tohu vavohu. Okay, do you see that, how the accent is helping me? Now, I got all the way to tohu in here, right? Tohu, what? Oh, no, there's two of them. Well, actually, because in this case, the pashta always has to come by Masoretic rules at the end of the word, after the last word. But in this case, they were helpful, and they doubled it to show you which syllable it goes on. Now, this doesn't always happen, unfortunately. There is a version called the Koran Bible that you can get. It's a Jewish one to help learn how to read. It actually, they've gone through and intentionally doubled all of the ones that need to be doubled so that you can always find the proper accent. So if you didn't know that before, now that can help you practicing reading out loud and getting more comfortable with that side of things. These are also called the ta'amim. Now the term ta'am in modern Hebrew means something like your taste. Okay, but if we can take it more generally, it's referring to the sense. It's giving you the sense of the text. And that's what we want to look at a little bit more today. While the other two are helpful, we're looking at this more from the sense of how are they helping me understand the sense of the text. And we'll look at that a little bit later in the thing. But I have a question. What do we have to do with Tiberius? Maybe you've heard some things about the Masoretes, the men who were responsible for getting these accents in the text, that they put these things in there to intentionally, read it in a Jewish way, not a Christian way, and things have been changed and that sort of thing. I want to tell you some of the positive things about that and why we can look at this in a way that I think should be helpful. The Masoretic tradition begins around 600 AD. It climaxed with the work of Aharon ben Asher in AD 915, so the 10th century, and he's responsible for putting this all down in the Aleppo Codex, which if you've been to Israel, in the Shrine of the Book, there's the Dead Sea Scrolls, and down below is the Aleppo Codex. So one of the interesting things is, with doing Old Testament text criticism, is we actually have that text. Right now, that text is only 1,000 years old, and yet we actually have that text, which is amazing. And then there's obviously Leningrad and others that we consult with, but we have that very text from the Masoretes. So as far as what the Masoretes wrote, for most of the text, we possess the very thing that Aharon ben Asher put down. A Masoretic scholar summarizes the development this way, so I'm just going to quote from him for a moment. It appears that the first to work on Masoretic issues were the Soferim, the pupils of Ezra the scribe, and this was in the early Second Temple period. Their work extended into the period of the Talmud, about 300 to 600 CE, and after this, the period of the Masoretes began, and their work continued until the final establishment of the received Tiberian tradition, including its vocalization, which you all use, and accentuation in the 10th century. To some extent, the work of clarifying the textual tradition and preserving it according to the tradition of the Masorah has continued up to our time. What I want you to get from that is that these men were seeking to take forward a tradition that they had all the way back from the time of Jesus, and I would even argue from before that. But what they did is they innovated this system of vowel pointings and then the accents to help us actually read the tradition that they had been passing along generation to generation in an oral fashion. So this goes back a long ways. Another important thing to consider, Yosef Ofer talks about how in the 10th century, what we might call an ancient linguist or someone who is interested in historical languages would go to Tiberias. So the Masoretes were from Tiberias in the land of Israel. And he would go and he would sit in the marketplace and he would write down what he would hear people saying. specifically how they were pronouncing things, because even the common people in the market in Tiberias were talking in Hebrew. Now, many people think that after the fall of the temple, just Hebrew was gone. It was only a frozen language. But people continued to use it in small pockets, and one of those places was Tiberias. So in the 10th century, the time when Aharon ben Asher was writing down the Aleppo Codex, he was in a community where Hebrew was actually being used on a daily basis in a living fashion. Now, obviously, the language had probably changed and developed from that time, and yet they still were using Hebrew very much like what we have in the scriptures. So I think that those are both that historical development and the fact that they were using the language are two good reasons that we ought to figure out what can these accents that these men have put in here help us understand. So why should we learn these accents? First of all, they confirm the sense of the text. I'm not telling you here today you need to go and learn how to learn to read the accents. You need to read Hebrew, right? You need to read Hebrew, but by knowing something about the accents, you can consult them to confirm what you've read in Hebrew, right? You can consult them to see, I'm reading this in Hebrew. What do you think, Ezra? Okay, good. We got the same thing. Or, I'm having trouble with this. Can you help me clarify this? I could see it going this way. I could see it going that way. And then you could look at the accents to help clarify that difficulty. Just this past week, I had someone who was working in another country forward an email onto me. And they were looking at this text from Genesis 19:9. Comes at the really intense moment in Sodom and Gomorrah, okay? And the conversation's going on, and Lot has finally just told them, don't do this wicked thing. He's just called them out. So they say, Vayomeru gesh hala'a, okay? So get out of the way, all right? We're done talking. Vayomeru ha'echad ba lagur vayishpot shafot. Okay, so you can see here, we have etnachta, or atnach, if you've learned it that way, which marks the major break in the verse. So this person who emailed me knew that. They knew, okay, I understand where the major break in the verse is, but in the first half of the verse, I'm having problem. There's this word, ata. It's got the same basic accent as the word before it, except this one is called zakef, and this one's called Zakef Gadol. They want to know, does Ata go with this phrase before it, or does it go after? Are these men from Sodom saying, this one came to sojourn, and has he indeed now become our judge? Or does it say, has he indeed become our judge? Now we will do worse to you. We will do evil to you more than them. Which one does it go with? Well, I just looked at the accents, and one of the basic rules is if you have the same accent repeated, the major break comes after the first occurrence of it. It's right here. So ata goes with what comes after. Now, we may say that's of rather minor exegetical significance, but when you're actually having to write down a copy of God's word for people, you take questions like that pretty seriously. And hopefully we all are willing to invest that amount of mental energy in figuring things out. So here, and knowing the accents helped clarify that difficulty, and I was able to email that off and hopefully be of help to them. One other reason is simply they can function as a commentary on the meaning, actually giving more of the sense, waving a little red flag to say, hey, pay attention to this. Pay attention to this. If you were just in Dr. Gentry's session, you'll notice he was talking about discourse issues that can kind of draw your attention to something, important piece of information that's being put in an offline category by not being put in the sequential pattern. Well, that can also happen with the accents as well. So it's something worth looking at. So go ahead and pull out your chart if you'd like to look at it. You can write all over it. But the best way to look at these things is to start to figure out the hierarchy or the layers of learning that can go on here. I'm going to say there's three basic levels we could talk about with this. More of a beginner level. How can the accents help me at a beginner level? How can they help me at an intermediate level, and how can they help me at a little bit more of advanced level? If I'm going to put on all the effort to learn this, where can it get me? Okay. So let's look at an example first. Simply identifying clauses. So again, if you were just in Dr. Gentry's seminar talking about looking at discourse grammar or something of that nature, I've laid this out actually according to a basic discourse analysis that you can find in Garrett and DeRouchy's grammar towards the back that talks about laying this out clause by clause. And the main thing you look for is, for every finite verb, it's going to get its own line in being laid out as a clause. Okay, so I've laid this out according to that pattern, according to these rules of discourse grammar. You've got a finite verb in each section, except for down here in D and E. I break them out just for observation purposes. But basically, I'm following that pattern. But I want you to notice something as well. At the end of each line, what do we see here? At the end of the first line, you're going to see et nachta. Do you see that on your chart? The third one down, one of the kings there. One of the strongest breaks is right there. The next line, 13b, it breaks at siluk. Right? The next line breaks at segol or segolta. You can see that in the princes section. So verse 14 is a bit longer, but it's still got one of the strongest disjunctives at the end of that line. How about 14b? We have zakef. How about 14c? We have etnachta. And then 14d and e, like I said, I've broken them out. And who knows? You're familiar with this passage from Esther. And who knows whether to a time like this you have come to the kingdom. Right, so I've broken these out for other purposes, but you can still see here, zakef, one of the stronger accents is at the end. So what I've done there is simply followed a discourse pattern for laying it out, and I've confirmed my reading. I've turned to Ezra and said, hey, what do you think about this? He's saying, all right, that's how we saw it too. So do you see how that's functioning? This is again, I'm saying at a basic level, because I actually like to read like this as opposed to just kind of everything. I read out of a Hebrew Bible, and yet when I'm actually studying, I'll lay it out in clauses like this because it helps me start to see the different clauses, and I can look at the relationships between them. We're going to do some more of this. But does anyone have any questions as we're looking at this on the screen for what I'm doing here? I'm laying it out by clauses, and then I'm confirming that I actually did it right by looking at how the Masoretes did it. Yeah, so again, I mentioned earlier, I want to read Hebrew. And so I just read the Hebrew, and I'll lay it out the best I can, trying to almost blind myself to the accents. And then I go back and I'll see, okay, did I look at that correctly? I'll see where the major breaks are. And if I've made a break that doesn't end with one of those major disjunctives, one of those kings or princes, ooh, I might want to look at that again. Maybe I was seeing something wrong there, and oftentimes it was just an error on my part in reading the Hebrew. I may have broken it somewhere in here, right? Here's the finite verb. I broke after the finite verb, and yet the next line doesn't have a finite verb. So I may have just been making an error, read a noun, read the morphology wrong, or something like that. So I'm trying to read Hebrew, and then what I'm doing is letting the Masoretes confirm that, yeah, I actually am reading the clauses correctly. So again, this is at the basic level, but you can see there, right there, the siluk et nachta tipecha zakef and segol, if you learn those ones, you're on your way with most shorter sentences in Hebrew to just having that little bit of commentary from Ezra or Aharon ben Asher. Okay? Zakef, and then there's Zakef Gadol, which is why I have it in parentheses there. So you can see in the symbol category, there's Zakef, which is just the two dots. And then you have Zakef Gadol, which is the dots in the line. Okay? So those symbols get used interchangeably. Zakef Gadol gets used when there's nothing in front of it. So it's butted up right against something. So you saw there back in Genesis 19, right? There was a kaf, and then immediately after it, there was a kaf gadol. So there's different rules for that, and you don't need to know any of those. It's just simply at the beginning level, you can just identify these major disjunctive accents, and they can help confirm, yeah, I'm reading the basic groupings of clauses correctly, okay? So if you have more questions, you can bring them up. Let's jump along to another use for this, okay? And I'm calling that grouping clauses or interpreting clause relationships. Here we might ask the question a little bit more deeply than just, okay, what are clauses? Which are the right clauses? But which clauses go together? Which clauses go together? So again, if you were just in Dr. Gentry's session about discourse grammar, there's a way that discourse grammar helps you read that. You can also look at that in terms of the accents to help figure out any discrepancies that you may have. Okay, so let's just look here. If you remember from what Gentry was talking about, if you were in there, we've got sequentials beginning everything, right? Vaitikach, vaitasem, vaitavo, vaititka, vaititznach, vehu. Well, that's different. Vayaaf, vayamot. Okay? So something's going on there. I'm going to hop out of the PowerPoint for just a second, make this bigger. Zoom in for you all. That's a little too much. All right. So my question is, this vehu, does this vav connect to this, or is this idea starting something new? In other words, is this a break? Now, if you remember from the rules that the discourse ideas that Dr. Gentry was talking about, if you were in that session, this is a break structure. The vav with something in between and then the verb is going to say, don't read this in sequence. Put this off by itself. So what I'm going to do is put this in like that. Okay? Now you have to make a decision. Now you have to make a decision because the next verb is a sequential. Does this pick up from here or does this pick up from here and needs to be indented with it? Okay? So if you're all familiar with this story, okay? Yael and Sisera has come to her tent, right? And vaititka et hayated baraketo. She drove the tent peg into his head. Vaititznach ba'aretz, it sunk into the earth. And this said, vehu nirdam. Vehu nirdam. So, and he was sleeping. The next verb, vaya'af, and he was tired. Okay? What do you think? Where does it go? What's it following? What's that? Vehu. Okay, so if we want to put it in, I'm going to do this. Put it under there to show that it's connected there. Let's see if that sense makes sense. This makes sense. Vehu nirdam vaya'af. Okay? And he was sleeping due to being tired. Okay, that makes some sense. I can see that. How about the next one? Vayamot. Is that connected to, and it sank into the earth through his head? Or is that connect to, and he was tired? Do I want to indent it, or do I want to leave it there to show that it's in sequence with what's on the right? I'm going to leave it there. Okay, I think that that's a good conclusion. Let's ask Ezra, did we get it right? Okay, let's ask Ezra. Okay, so here's et nachta, the biggest break in the verse, right? Everyone can see that because I just showed you how to look at the kings and the princes on your chart and see, oh, yep, that's a pretty strong break right there. Okay, so the fact that we have a grammatical break structure afterwards, that makes sense, right? The Masoretes knew that. They were fluent Hebrew speakers, so they put this huge break right before the grammatical break. Oh, that sounds right. Vehu nirdam. Now, you're going to have to dig on your charts, but in the bottom left corner are your conjunctive accents. Conjunctive accents say, read this word with what follows. Okay, there's not a break after this word. This goes with something after it. Okay, so we have merecha, and here we have tipecha, another one of your major breaks. Okay, so these two actually go, if you had them in sequence, there's this one's swinging to the next, and this one is pointing back at it. Those two words ought to be read together, which puts a nice little break in here. So this is one section of the verse, all of this. The break is here, which frees this up to be considered as part of the sequence up here. One other reason we can know that is tipecha could go on this. If they only wanted this over here, and they wanted this verb, let's say, and he was sleeping, and he died, and the blood ran out. Okay? You know, let's say that's what the verbs are here. They could put this accent here, put the break right there, and then this could swing back over if they needed to. The Masoretes could have done that. But we read the Hebrew grammatically, and then we looked to see that's how the Masoretes wanted us to read it too. So we're reading in line with this tradition that was passed down for 1,000 years from the time of Jesus. Okay? So that's not just interpreting what clauses are broken out, but how the clauses go together. So you can see that if you look at your chart, just so that the chart is more helpful for you, if in the future you're looking at it, in that second column, the conjunctives, what I've done is tried to simplify it, and the terms are still in Hebrew, but you can kind of match what you can guess from the Hebrew, or you can write them in English if you want to. But if you look at tipecha, typically the conjunctive right before it is going to be merecha, okay? Whereas siluk typically has merecha, et nachta typically has munach, which looks different, okay? Munach is like a 90-degree angle underneath it. So, and then when you get down, obviously it gets much more complex with the numbers. But again, just functioning in the top two boxes, the kings and princes, you can look at what fits there. So you can start to see these common patterns to help figure out these multiple words should be read together as a unit. Okay? Before we jump on to the next section, any questions with this? All right, one more thing to point out here. You might have been wondering, okay, what qualifies something as a king or a prince or a duke or a count? That language I'm getting from Fuller and Choi's Invitation to Biblical Hebrew Syntax. Okay, so you can look at that. If you look at Jacobson's Chanting the Hebrew Bible, he'll talk about it level 1, level 2, level 3, level 4. So kings are level 1, level 2 is princes. So every level is subservient to that which is above it. Pretty simple, okay? So what I mean by that is here, this section right at the end, these three clauses end with siluk. This is the king over this section here. And what is a servant of the king? A prince. Our prince in this case is tipecha. Okay? Let's look at the top half, for example. The king here is etnachta. Okay? And he has a number of different princes. Okay? We can see Zakef here, and we can see Zakef here. And then they have those that are under them with other accents. Okay? So I just want you to see the levels in which you read things. You could read it by whatever comes at the end, that rules over everything before it. And then we have to take another level down, and we can start to look at smaller and smaller sections. That only becomes important in very long verses. The shorter verse is typically going to function in these top two sections, the kings and princes, for what you're mostly going to be looking at. But that is the grouping of clauses. Let me jump back to the actual PowerPoint here. Now, we're supposed to end at 3:50. I'm going to skip this example, but one thing you can do is if you want to practice, is you can export text from your Bible software without the cantillation marks and practice reading it, and then you can actually look at it with the cantillation marks and see, oh, I just breezed right through that, and that was the major stopping point in this, which you could see from this example, but we'll just go on to the next because I want you to see the last idea. Okay, so you can use the axis to help you figure out where the clause breaks. Okay, I just want to know what the basic breaks are. I want to be able to confirm that I read it correctly. I want to be able to group clauses together. So that's where you have to start learning what accents go together, and that can show you this is a whole phrase. We need to read that whole phrase together, like he was sleeping and was tired, right? That idea. You can also look at them for indicating literary interest. So this is a little bit more advanced. You need to know a bit more about what they do. This is what I did my dissertation work on, if you really wanted to go a long ways in studying that. But let's look at an example to see if this is helpful in figuring this out, okay? One of the things that they typically will do, okay, so I studied the book of Judges. 83% of the time in the book of Judges, whenever direct speech ends in the middle of a verse, it gets etnachta. Okay, it gets the biggest break of the verse at the end of direct speech. It's like a quotation mark. We have those in English, right? So you can have a sentence that ends with a comma but has quotation mark on it, so you know that the quote ended, but it's still going on. You don't want to think that the rest of the verse, all the way to the end of the verse, is the quotation. Let's look at this example here. Okay. Vayhi miyamim bimei katsir chitim. Okay, so it happened in the days of the wheat harvest. Vayifkod Shimshon et ishto bigdi izim. Okay, and Samson visited his wife with a kid or a young goat. Vayomer, avoa el ishti hechadra. I will go to my wife in the chamber. Velo nitano aviha lavo. Okay, now if you were just reading this in block text, you might just assume vayomer, and his speech is going to go all the way to the end of the verse. That's a lot of the time how speech happens, right? The direct quote will just go all the way to the end, but it doesn't in this verse. Samson has a very short phrase, and actually, afterwards, it's a very important stop. And her father would not permit him to go, okay? So Samson says, I'm going in there, and he says, no. He's not permitting it. Now, you can see here, in a sense, just we would expect, and we do get it, that etnachta comes at the end of direct speech to make sure, hey, quotation mark, quote ends here, something else is going on here that you need to know about that's not Samson still talking, okay? Don't just breeze past it. You got to stop. So even for those in the synagogue setting who are chanting the text, they put a brief pause with the etnachta, and they continue chanting the next part. So the melodies would also help you there, but most of us aren't going to listen to it that way. So we have to be able to look at these symbols and say, hey, the big break is there. That probably means the quotation ended. And as I'm trying to point out, 83% of the time. Look at this though, okay? This is also odd. If we just think about just in terms of punctuation, just slide this line up here right after Vayomer. There's like four nice, perfectly even lines. If this is breaking the verse, it just makes sense to go here, right? This is halfway. If you count the words, so to speak, this is the halfway point of the verse. But they've waited all the way here until just four or five words before the end of the verse to put the biggest break. Again, doesn't matter where the end of direct speech comes. If the direct speech ends in the middle of the verse, they're going to put the biggest possible break there because they want you to make sure you understand the quote stops here, but the verse goes on. Okay? So if I've sufficiently convinced you of that, if I've not sufficiently, you can go read all of the research. But hopefully this one example is you're willing enough to go along with it. Okay? Now let's look at another example. Same sort of story, same characters. Vayomer Shimshon, tamot nafshi im plishtim, vayet Bakoach. Okay, so I think Samson's done talking. We got a vav sequential here. And Samson said, let my soul die, let my life die with the Philistines. And he stretched out, or pushed out with strength. Okay, so he's here between the pillars, right? And the action is actually continuing. If you're in the discourse one, you see the action picked up again after the speech has ended. But the Masoretes didn't put the Etnachtah there. And I'll just tell you from other examples, they're perfectly comfortable with it coming very early or very late. It doesn't matter where the direct speech ends. They want you to know, stop the quote. We get a segol or segolta at the end there. What's going on? Vayipol habayit al hasranim ve'al kol ha'am asher bo. Okay, and the house fell upon the princes and all the people which were in it. Etnachta. They want the stop to be there. And then we get a statement afterwards. Vayihyu hametim asher bamit b'moto rabim me'asher hemit b'chayav. So those that died at his death were more than those that died in his life, okay? Samson ended up killing more people in this one episode. More Philistines died here than he had killed in the rest of his life, even with the jawbone incident. Why did they do that? Why did they break their pattern? Well, these Masoretes, they're just kind of willy-nilly with this stuff. Maybe some guy was sleeping that day and he wasn't really paying attention. He didn't know the rule, right? Or maybe this is one of those times where, hey, this is a really important part of the story. Normally, we would put it up there, but we didn't this time. And why didn't we do that this time? Because we want you to pay attention. The story of Samson's ending here. Samson dies with all these Philistines, and more of them died at this moment than died in the entire rest of his life. And so we're willing to break our pattern with the accents so that you see that. So that's why I say this is a little bit more of an advanced thing, because you have to start to learn what they typically do with the accents to know when they didn't do it here. So maybe they're doing something else. Maybe something is more important here that they want me to pay attention to. Now, they didn't totally break it, because look, Segol is just the next level down, right? They still want you to see, hey, the quote ended. Don't miss that the quote ended. So they'd use the next strongest thing that they could. Don't remember what I said earlier, don't pay attention to these guys, because this is on the same level with them. So the biggest break in the top half of the verse is right there. So they're still following their pattern, but in breaking their pattern, they're trying to give you a little bit of a literary interest. Most of the time this happens is usually toward the end or the climax of a story. And again, you're going to read a story and you're going to be informed enough to know this is the important part of the story. So that's a perfect place to look for. The accents might be doing something a little bit different here. Okay? The other example that you can look at, let's actually go back to it for a sec. In an example like this, okay? Another common pattern is that when you have a apodosis construction, if, then, or when, then, as we have here. And it was when the king saw Esther, the queen, standing in the palace. We got Zakef, right? And we have Etnachtah. Okay, he extended, he lifted up grace in his eyes, okay? So we see this when he saw her. So again, look, there's no vav at the beginning again. So we can read Hebrew, we can read the discourse, but the accents are also helping us. The prodesis ended with a prince, so the apodosis is going to end with the appropriate king. Okay, that's the common pattern. 89% of the time in the book of Judges, that's what happens. Okay, so I'm trying to extend my research out to see the rest of Scripture, but you can see that here. When, then, and then the next verse is an action. Vayushet hamelech le'ester et sarvit. He extended the scepter to her. Okay? That's the common pattern. If you see a prodesis, apodesis, and something is different about that, That's another time where, hey, Masoretes broke their pattern to wave a little flag about something. Okay, so I'm saying this is a normal pattern right here. I would expect that. But this is another type of construction where, again, if you know that that's how they do it normally, and they don't, it's an opportunity for Ezra to say, this is really important. Okay? So that's how you can use them, I would say, on a more advanced level for getting the exegesis. Here's a couple of resources for further study. They're also listed at the bottom of your chart there. If you want to look them up, you can just Google those authors and those works. So we have just a couple more minutes. I'm open for a few questions if anyone has any. Dr. Howell? Yep.
You had the segment there a moment ago, the ethnox segment that had the Sunk Cave, Sigolta, yeah, right there.
Mm-hmm.
You said this Sigolta, if you've got consecutive same level accents,
yeah.
The first one is the heaviest one.
Absolutely,
that
yep.
That would be the case if you had two Sunk Caves.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. That's not
yep.
Good.
So, yeah, so we've got. Let's just imagine that part's right there. All we have is Zakef, Zakef. Well, then, if this was the first one, this would be the biggest break. But in this case, because Segol is on the same level as Zakef and actually substitutes based on some other rules, again, you don't need to know those rules. You can just know that these two guys are on the same level, that the higher, the more important prince is the first one that you encounter. That's the biggest break. And so in this case, they did. They followed their pattern. They gave us the strongest prince they could. They couldn't give us the king because they wanted to point our attention there. So they gave us the strongest prince. Okay, so you get the second best guy instead of the best guy. Good question.
So in that case, would the next prince be subordinate to that prince?
Well, in that case, all of the princes are still subordinate to the king. Okay, they all report to the king. But all those other princes know that this guy's more important than me. You know, he's got a bigger slice of the kingdom than I do. We're all on the same level, but he's, you know, the prince premier as opposed to me just being the prince. So they're not subordinate to that. They're not a level down. They're still subordinate to the king. And yet, if we're going to say, where's the line going to break? It's going to break with the first guy, the big man. Yep. Oh, excuse me, the 21 books. So there's a system for the 21 books, which are mostly made up of narrative and then the prophetic books. And then you have the three, which is Job, Psalms, and Proverbs. They have a totally different system of accents. Okay, they use a lot of the same symbols. I gave you this because most of the time you're going to do most of your reading in the 21 books of the Hebrew Bible. So the reason there's so many less is, right, because the book of the 12 is considered one book, right? And other books like Ezra and Nehemiah are considered one book. So it's called the book of the 21. So if you look at William Wicks, for example, he's got a book about the 21 and then a book about the three, okay? The reason that the three aren't as important for you to study is because it's pretty much all poetry, so you get the parallelisms. And most of the time when you have a lot of parallelisms functioning, the accents are just following the parallelisms. That's oversimplifying things, but just know that. This is most helpful for you in prose because the narrative doesn't have punctuation. And so this is helping you understand how things are broken up. Sir? Job, Psalms, and Proverbs. Those are the other three. Yeah, so this system does operate in poetic sections of the prophets and that sort of thing. But again, you'll see, you can just go ahead and look at those. You'll see most of the time where the parallelism breaks. These guys, sometimes the BHS doesn't follow that. It says that the poetry is breaking in a different place than the Masoretes did. So again, important to know the difference. The publishers say this and the Masoretes said this. You can study it on your own. Other questions? Yeah, so in some cases the section will be so small that it doesn't warrant having a far subordinate. So for example, the Siluk segment, you look, his near guy is Tipcha and his far guy is Zakef. So let me go back here. So right, look at the end here. Here's Siluk. This section The see, Luke section is only right here. There's 1, 2, 3, 4 words. It's so small, he doesn't have a Zakef, right? His only subordinate here is Tipcha. So, but if he had, you know, 20 words, he may have both Tipcha and Zakef. In those instances, the far subordinate is stronger, okay? Think of it this way. A king, if he's got two guys, and he's got, they're both his subordinates, but he trusts one guy more, he's going to send him further away to do his work because he trusts him, right? He knows that he's going to do the work, represent him well, and the other guy's going to keep a little closer, right? So the farther guy is stronger. And so the major break in that section is going to occur there. So you can look here, right? Et Nachta, in his section, he's got these two Zakefs. So here's the major break, even though he has a Tipcha right here. Right? So the Tipcha just becomes a basic disjunctive there. But the real important break we want to look for is the far guy. If there's a near and far, you want to look at the far guy as being where the major break is. Sir?
Yeah, when you say near and far, you're
meaning some. Yes, so counting backwards, the nearer one would be within a few words typically, and the further one can go up to 10, 20 words away. There's different rules for counting those things. Well, what I will do, since this segment is over, I'll let you all go. And if you have any more questions, I'm willing to stick around and talk about those. But thanks so much for being here, and God bless the rest of your time and your studies.